With our two special guests this hour, Philip Haney, Art Moore, their work, See Something, Say Nothing. We'll take some of your calls as well when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Art Moore with us and Philip Haney. Art, so in your work with Philip, in your opinion, why is this government protecting Saudi Arabia, for example, and probably some other nations?
Well, I think it's clear that the relationship we have is twofold. One, of course, is economic, the oil, and then second, mm-hmm. the strategic relationship. They've been an ally in the Middle East, but as you see in our story, one of the most remarkable events, we talked a little bit about Boston, but there's a whole other aspect of that story, and some people remember the day after the bombing took place, there was a Saudi citizen who was identified as a person of interest. The FBI went in and searched his apartment, came out with bags of, it came out with computers and bags of things. And just a few days later, the Homeland Security Committee was questioning Janet Napolitano, who at that time was the DHS secretary, and they're asking her, what about this guy, this person of interest, and why, and this is the information that they were getting, why are you about to deport him if he's somebody who not only might have been involved, but at the very least, knew something about what was going on. Apparently, he could be an eyewitness. Why are you deporting him? And Napolitano was indignant. She, why are you even asking such a question? And it was just ridiculing. It was Representative Jeff Duncan. And it turns out that information that Duncan had that he used to ask those questions came from Philip. He was right at the center of this, and really what it boils down to is, it seems very clear from the evidence that we were protecting our relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Art and Philip, ISIS. Let's address ISIS for just a moment. It seemed like it was created overnight, but there's no way it could have been. How did this foundation, Philip, in your opinion, how did this foundation develop? Who built it?
Well, the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, did an on-the-ground assessment of the situation in Benghazi. They published their report in August of 2012, 1 month before the subsequent attacks. We wouldn't have known about this intelligence analysis had it not been for Judicial Watch, FOIA, Freedom of Information request, on information related to Benghazi. And lo and behold, we found out when the documents were released through the FOIA request, three fundamental facts on the ground there in Benghazi. Number one, they were shipping small allotments of weapons from Benghazi to small ports along the coast of Syria. Number two, they were providing these allotments of weapons to Ansar al-Sharia type of groups, Jamaat al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda of Iraq, and amazingly, the Muslim Brotherhood. They're on the ground in Syria fighting in opposition to Assad. But the third most ominous point that they discussed in these FOIA documents was that the Western powers, the alliances that are supporting them, encouraged them to take eastern Syria as a buffer between Assad, the leader of Syria, and Iran, to create a buffer so that the influence of Iran, who was supporting Assad, would be diminished. Well, they did exactly that. They took eastern Syria. So what was the next logical thing that they did after that? Took western Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They went into Fallujah.
Which we're trying to get back now.
Exactly. If you go online and Google, look at the pictures of the men that came into those cities waving the black flag,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is not the ISIS flag, it's the flag of jihad. Whenever you see a black flag with white lettering, that is active jihad campaign. If you ever see a white flag with black lettering, it means that they've won.
They've won? Okay.
But when you see a black flag, predominantly black flag, that is a declaration, a signal, like a semaphore flag on a Navy ship of an active jihad campaign.
They're panicking today, Philip. Apparently they've been lining up what they consider to be internal spies, and they're shooting them like crazy. It sounds like they're disintegrating from within, are they?
Well, if they are, that is not going to suddenly make the problem go away.
No, I agree.
Because as the leader of ISIS, or one of the major top commanders, said quite recently, that they don't see defeat as a sign of the end. They see it as a incentive to try even harder. And that is the thing about this power of Sharia that I keep coming back to, because it really is the center of understanding of what motivates every jihadi on the face of the earth, is that they are bound, they are compelled to promote Islam and implement Sharia law. And if they fail, if they're defeated, that doesn't mean that they should stop.
Yet there are many Muslims, though, Philip and Art, many, many Muslims, and I know a lot of them in this country, who are great Americans. They love our way of life. They send their kids to public school. They're doctors, they're dentists, they're lawyers. They don't want problems at all. Why are they that way, and these others are as militant as they are?
Well, first of all, there are at least 25 surveys that have been conducted over the last 10-15 years, both in the United States and in Western countries like the UK, that are remarkably similar in their results. And that is that within the Islamic community in any given country, including the United States and or European, somewhere between 40% and 60% of the population of the Muslim communities in these different countries actually support implementation of Sharia law. And a smaller but not significant percentage of that group supports the use of violence if necessary to promote and protect and implement Sharia law. That is a very difficult point to get past. And we have never had a discussion in the history of America or a situation where this subject has come up, where you actually have two competing legal systems, if you will. You have two competing worldviews trying to find space in the same location, which, of course, we know, according to physics, is impossible. And in my active duty career, I interviewed, I can't even tell you how many people my age, you know, fathers, grandfathers. And I would say, you're going to come to a crisis point in your life, either today, tomorrow, next week, when your son comes to you from the mosque and points his finger at you and says, Papa, you're not a good Muslim because you don't observe Sharia law. And then that moment, when that moment comes, friend, you're going to have a crisis because you're going to have to decide what you really believe. Do you believe in the Constitution and the truths that are self-evident, that we have been endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights? Or are you going to choose to support Sharia law, whatever those consequences might mean? And that is the great conflict, the great crisis that's facing the Islamic community in America this very day.
When does it all blow up, Philip? Because eventually it's got to.
It's like watching a slow motion reaction. You know, you see it in super slow motion where the object starts to fly apart and pieces start going off in every direction. Inevitably, Sharia is always incompatible with any other form of government because it states it itself that it comes from Allah and that Sharia is supreme. It has to take the place of every other form of government. And at many times in history, it actually did. But America is not immune from that force. Now, how are we going to address it? It's going to take honesty and courage to do it. Am I saying that it's impossible? No. But I am saying that it's impossible if we insist on refusing to even discuss the reality of the power of Sharia law within the Islamic community. As long as we fail to do that, we're never going to be able to come to a point where we can really address it. And then it'll result in conflict.
But you're not recommending shutting down mosques or things like that, are you? I don't hear that coming from you.
What I'm recommending is a fundamental discussion. We haven't even got to that point of where we can actually honestly address it. For example, there's an organization in America. It is called the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. It's a Muslim Brotherhood-linked organization, but not just, because it's also a global-level organization. There are similar types of assembly organizations all over the world. The Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America issues fatwas, which they post on their website in English, discussing questions that American Muslims have to deal with, like whether they should go to work for the U.S. government, or whether they should become a law enforcement officer, or whether they should pay interest on their home loans, or whether they should join the military. And the name Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America sounds reasonably benign. It doesn't sound very threatening. But if you hear it in Arabic, it's completely different. It's Majama Fuqaha Sharia de Amrikia. Means the Assembly of Lawyers Promoting Sharia in United States. So the argument that there is no effort to implement Sharia law is false. And that's the kind of thing that we have to address before we ever come to the point where we can really address it or deal with it. The organization, Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America, is the most powerful pro-Sharia organization, and it provides leadership to all the mosques in the United States and in Canada. Again, it sounds benign, AMJA, Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. But in its Arabic name, which is right on the top of their logo, you can go on the website, you look at their logo, it's a green logo with the circle of the earth, and across the top, across the arch of the top, is the Arabic name. And right there, in pure Arabic grammar, is the word Sharia.
Of course, you may be one of the few to be able to read that.
Well, they're not obligated to translate it for us. They're obligated to tell us what they intend to do, but it's up to us to have the wisdom and discernment to see what is actually literally standing right in front of us.
So with all this being said, and let's assume all of it is accurate, why isn't Homeland Security or administrations, this one, the one previous, and the next one, are they going to do anything about this?
Well, that remains to be seen. I certainly hope so, and I'm certainly willing to help. That's the point of the whole book. The remarkable thing about See Something, Say Nothing is that it's a live story. It's history captured in a book.
And it's still happening.
Huh?
And it's still happening.
There's nothing in the book that's actually been resolved yet. What I mean is, every story is still alive. The Saudi individual who we discussed earlier is suing Glenn Beck for slander. He's a foreign national. This is a constitutional level case. A foreign national coming back to America to sue a U.S. citizen, whether you like what Glenn Beck said or not, that's not the point. The point is the preservation of freedom of speech. And if they're able to shut somebody like Glenn Beck down, they're going to shut everybody down who says anything critical of Islam. And that's why this case is so important. And that's the ominous part about the aftermath of the Boston bombing, is this individual that the DHS insisted essentially didn't even exist is literally here, back in the country, suing an American citizen for what that American citizen said on his own TV show.
Well, let's see what happens in discovery and everything else, because the documents should fly on this. Let's take some calls for both of you in the time we've got remaining. Let's go to Charles in Baltimore to get things started. Charles, go ahead.
Yes. I wonder if Americans are really willing to fight for our freedom. It doesn't seem like. It seems like that this administration has basically invited the Muslims in to do what they want, doesn't even care. I'm also surprised, really, that I know they have the Quran in Braille, but I haven't seen anything else put into Braille. I'm sure there are some blind Muslims around. I've never met one before, but and plus, okay, are they trying to spread their word like we try to spread Christianity around the world? Are the Muslims trying to spread Islam? They're trying to counter what Christianity teaches?
Oh, you want that, Art, or you, Philip?
Sure. I think this is really what we're talking about is the spread of Islam. And as Philip described, through many different means, through violence, obviously we know about that, but also through persuasion. And so that would be similar to Christian missionaries going about talking to people one-to-one or declaring the word to people. But the problem that we're talking about here, which is very different from every other religion just about, is the fact that we're talking about an interpretation of Islam, a supremacist Islam that is inherently political. And so when Philip talks about Sharia, what he's talking about is the encroachment of a religious system on our constitutional system.
Well, then that's the big issue. We should have nothing that circumvents the Constitution. Nothing. And it just appears to be that way. And Philip, in your opinion, is this administration doing anything to combat this? Or is it just kind of trying to brush it underneath the carpet?
Well, as you read in the book, you'll find that I'm sorry to say that it's predominantly the latter.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And an honest assessment would lead anyone to that same conclusion, especially regarding the Holy Land Foundation trial that Art mentioned earlier. Because a fundamental realization is that when the Department of Justice proved irrefutably in federal court that these American Muslim Brotherhood front groups were providing financial support to Hamas, that was November of 2008. Everything that was done after that point, if you wanted to possibly argue that before then, maybe they didn't know, okay, we can argue that point.
Mm-hmm.
After November 2008, you cannot argue that point any longer. It's impossible to say that they didn't know.
We're going to come back and take final questions with both of you next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, a couple events I want to tell you about. Saturday, June 18th in St. Louis at Lindenwood University, a live stage show that we're putting on. Come on out and enjoy yourself. It's going to be a neat time. We're doing a meet and greet after the event. It's just going to be a great time. Full details at coasttocoastam.com. You can get there. It's right by the highlight reel. Just check that, and it'll show you where to get tickets and stuff. And then if you scroll down a little bit at coasttocoastam.com, you'll see the August 27th event in Asheville, North Carolina, where that venue is filling up awfully quick. And Joshua P. Warren is going to be our headliner, along with Micah Hanks on UFOs and William Forstgen on EMPs and solar flares. Those tickets are clicking along. You can get them, too, by going to our website, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast with our two special guests, Philip Haney, Art Moore. Art, are you starting to get some publicity on the See Something, Say Nothing?
We are, yeah. In fact, we're getting really good responses from people who read the book. They love it. They say it's a page-turner, and it's really because of Philip's story. I mean, it's a blockbuster from the beginning, where you begin with he's at the National Targeting Center, which is the place where the actual data is kept that feeds out to all the people who are at the ports, the people that you come across when you come in and hand your passport. And he was working at that place, developing a case. The State Department comes in and says, we're going to shut down your case because it offends certain people with whom we have a relationship. We don't think these people that you're investigating are terrorists. Well, it turns out, just a few years later, as we experienced as a nation back in December, that that information directly related to the two killers of
San Bernardino
massacre.
Jeez.
And it's really, I think, fair to say that it's possible that if that case had not been eliminated by the State Department, and now we know actually because of documents that have been FOIA'd, we know that it was also the DHS Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. There's an actual office with that name. And those two together eliminated that case that possibly could have spared the lives of 14 people in San Bernardino.
In an effort to be politically correct, they've looked the other way, haven't they?
That's really what it amounts to. And his story goes on further, where he was actually ordered to alter or modify information because it was not politically correct. And there was information that he had that somebody else eliminated, just deleted from the database.
Okay, let's go back to the calls. Let's go to Harry in Port Huron, Michigan now. Harry, welcome to the program. Go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you guys very much, and I'm trying to get a hold of myself after hearing what you just said about what happened in San Bernardino. My blood's boiling at the moment. But I'm wondering, guys, have you heard of a great, great group called Understanding the Threat? And if you have, are you working with them? I hope.
Yes.
I haven't heard of them.
They are a fantastic group. They are out of Texas or Virginia, and they want to expose every Islamic terrorist here in the country. They're training law enforcement, and I get emails from them a lot. And John Guandolo and those guys, you need to get familiar with them and work with them because they'd love to have you, I'm sure.
Hey, Philip, let me ask you this, too. I mean, could this get to the point where paranoia takes over and every Muslim is looked at as a terrorist, and like the communists were of the 50s, where, you know, Hollywood was blamed, everything was blamed? Could it get out of hand that way?
That's why I keep emphasizing, let's push the reset button on the whole discussion, because that's counterproductive. And it's not going to help anything to focus on the individual or family or community as much as it is to make an honest effort to come to terms with what Sharia law really is and what it really represents, what its true intentions are, and then address that from a constitutional perspective. That's really the only way that we're going to be able to handle this, you know, as Americans we have done in the past and come to an understanding. I hope I'm making my point clear, is that there's an individual, there's a family, there's a community. We're all people. We all have same goals and desires in our life. But there are other influences that are involved in the equation that we cannot just pretend don't exist.
True.
And in this arena that we're discussing, which we've never addressed before, we've never had to, we encountered the Barbary pirates at the beginning of our country's history. We encountered declarations of jihad, plainly stated intentions of slave traders and pirates to take our ships, our crew, and our cargo from us if we sailed into the Mediterranean. Well, it really hasn't changed since then till now, just on a broader scale. So, if we're going to address it without paranoia, without freaking out, then the first thing that we need to do is come to an honest make an honest effort to really address what is Sharia law? What does it look like in this world that we live in? How is it practiced in other Islamic countries where it is actually followed? Because it won't look any different here. There is no Burger King. There is no do it your way. Sharia is very, very structured. And it's not just about the religious component of Islamic life. It has to do with what we call civil law. And that is really the point of conflict between Sharia and the U.S. Constitution. It's not the religious aspect of it per se. It's the points of what we call Sharia law. For example, a man is allowed to marry four women, to have four wives. Polygamy in the United States is illegal. If a person has more than one wife, in the old days when we first started DHS and we were enforcing immigration law, he would not be given a visa. Because it's illegal to have more than one wife in our civil society. So there is a point of contact right there in terms of the contrast between Sharia law and U.S. civil law. Which one will prevail? Will we make an exception because Islam is a global religion and therefore they're going to have special rights that the rest of the country don't have? Utah tried to implement polygamy, and of course, it's not legal in Utah.
No, look what happened to that. Well, I agree with you. The Constitution must live first and foremost, and our laws must live first and foremost. One of my concerns about illegal immigration, I'm all for immigration. I think that we should do the best we can to get great people in this country who want to learn and educate and build a life for their families and stuff. We should not allow criminals in and people like that. But it's got to be done legally. And a lot of people who are proponents of just plain immigration, illegal or otherwise, don't seem to get that, Philip.
Well, it goes all the way back to when we were kids and we read Aesop's Fables, the wolf in sheep's clothing. You know, there's a whole big flock of sheep, but there's a couple of wolves in there. And as a cop, as a former law enforcement expert, or a subject matter expert, federal officer, I took a vow, which I took very seriously. Every law enforcement officer in your audience right now, and every military, both former and active duty, took the same vow, and we all feel exactly the same way about it. We took it seriously. We will stand and defend our country, up to and including giving our life for it. But what are we defending? The Constitution. We have to keep that in mind. This is a clash between not people, not your neighbors, the Constitution, the form of law that was created by our founding fathers who were geniuses for a checks and balance governmental system, and a competing system of law that happens to have a religious component included in it called Sharia. If we don't address it now voluntarily, we will address it later involuntarily. Because it's like a chemical reaction. You keep adding the elements, and eventually there's going to be a reaction. And it's inevitable, because the power of Sharia law within the worldview and the ideology of Islam is, you know, it's inescapable. So we must come to terms with it. That's where the discussion needs to be based, is what is Sharia law, really? How is it really practiced in the rest of the world? And how are we going to address it from a constitutional basis? See, as long as I discuss this subject from a constitutional basis, I have absolutely solid ground to stand on. It's like building a case as a cop on probable cause.
Mm-hmm.
My probable cause platform is the Constitution. I don't need to veer into bias, discrimination, violation of civil rights, or arbitrary enforcement. All I need to do as a law enforcement officer is stand on the Constitution. But it's the same way for the citizens of America. Stand on the Constitution, and you will always be safe.
But will they?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? We need to go back and read the Declaration of Independence, probably the most radical document that's ever been written, because right in there in the opening statement it says it is incumbent upon the citizenry to change the government if it becomes tyrannical, but that we should not do it lightly. In fact, we would rather suffer harm than do it. But when the time comes, it's incumbent, it's the responsibility of the citizens of our country, if we want to preserve America as we know it, to finally make a stand, but not in bias and discrimination and overt civil rights violations, but simply to stand on the foundation of the U.S. Constitution. And then you are solid.
Let's go to Stanford, Connecticut. Keith's with us. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Hi, and thanks for having Art and Philip on the show for this important discussion. It's, wow. I mean, this is so important. I wanted to talk briefly about the Muslim Brotherhood. This is a group that was started in the 1920s, and they were in the World War II. They were the handpicked Islamic representation for Adolf Hitler. And this is a bad group that's been around for a long time. The number two is al-Zahiri. He still leads. He's still the leader of al-Qaeda. They tried to take over Egypt during the Arab Spring. Mubarak left. They had some sham election. They brought in Morsi, and thank goodness this Sisi, General Sisi, took over. But this is a really bad group, and for some reason, this group has had access to the White House. They've had visits with our White House representatives over 200 times in the last 7 years. And I don't know. I don't understand how we're ever going to address this problem with being cozy with a group like this. I just don't understand it.
Philip, is the group that dangerous?
The fellow that's just called in from Connecticut, did he say?
Yeah.
Is absolutely correct. His history is perfect, what he said. And his stats are correct as well. And the story in See Something, Say Nothing documents how much trouble I got in as a federal law enforcement officer with a subject matter expertise who took a vow to protect our country by having picked the one particular group that would get me in the most trouble, which was the Muslim Brotherhood. Because clear back in 06, 07, 08, I was what we call targeting. I was documenting. I was putting the dots into the system. And when the administration changed and they made the deliberate decision to bring the Muslim Brotherhood into a political alliance, obviously, I slammed into the wall. We had a head-on collision.
And they got you.
Well, they tried to. Nine times I was investigated. I tell people I'm the most thoroughly investigated whistleblower that's probably ever existed.
Investigated for what?
Well, for violation of the system, for putting the information into the system that they said I didn't have any authority to put into.
I bet they're glad you retired, Philip, aren't they?
Well, maybe. We'll see how this all unfolds, because as I said, the story is still alive. It has not been resolved.
Well, it's not going to go away, that's for sure.
No, it won't go away, and it will ultimately be resolved, whether we do it voluntarily or not, because this is a clash, and ultimately, if we want to preserve America as we know it, in all its variants and twists and turns throughout the history of our country, then we will eventually have to make the conscious decision to stand up for constitutional values. But the Muslim Brotherhood made a declaration in their strategic and tactical document called the Explanatory Memorandum that their intention was to subvert the U.S. government and essentially implement Sharia law. And they do it with a term that in Arabic is Al-Mutsima, Al-Qaeda, Al-Islamiyya. Al-Mutsima means the observant or obedient. Al-Qaeda means base. And Islamiyya means Islamic. Al-Qaeda did not start with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan in late 1990. It started with the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States in the late 1980s in the explanatory memorandum. Paragraph 1, page 1, Al-Mutsima, Al-Qaeda, Al-Islamiyya. It's right there, embedded right in their explanatory memorandum. Because Al-Qaeda is not an organization, it's a concept. And what it is the entire community coalescing into a unified forward direction. And that's what you're seeing if you know what to look for right here in the United States.
And again, though, it seems to have grown after Iraq and Libya. Am I right?
Well, because from an Islamic perspective, this is not seen as a violation of Quran. It is a movement. It is the same way that Islam spread from Saudi Arabia all the way across North Africa, clear into Spain in less than 100 years, culminating with the Battle of Tours in the year 732, right in the middle of France, with Charles Martel, Catholic king who assembled an army and stopped the advance of Islam in the middle of all places, France.
All right, quick question, yes or no. Is it a mistake to try to get Assad out of Syria?
He was more stable in the current situation.
Well, that's exactly right.
He's overthrown. It'll be
another chaos.
Fight each other for control of the area.
All right. Art and Philip, thanks for being on the program. Good luck with the book. See Something, Say Nothing, and keep fighting the good fight, you two, okay?
Thank you, George.
Thank you, everyone.
All right. Thank you. In a moment, we're going to be talking about, well, consciousness, the mind, and all kinds of things with Gerald Epling back on Coast to Coast. So make sure you're part of the program. He's got lots to say about some very interesting things.